Hello, everyone, and welcome back to RPG R&D. I'm one of your hosts, Jess Geyer. I make role-playing games. I'm one half of Wannabe Games, and I've switched that up today. And I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Craig Campbell. Hello, Craig.
Hello, I am Craig Campbell. That was unpredictable, Jess. You threw me.
Yeah, I know. I threw myself.
I'm the owner of Nerdburger Games. I also make tabletop role-playing games and a card game. And we are here with the incredibly difficult to schedule, but always a joy to have on the show, Sharang. Hello.
Hi, I'm Sharang Biswas. This must be like my fifth something appearance on the show. I've lost count. But it's always fun to be like on the show when my schedule permits it, which is not all the time.
No, well, it's for good reason that you're busy because, well, tell us a little bit about yourself for any new listeners.
I am Sharang Biswas. I am a game designer and writer and interactive artist. And I've started saying professor of games more often now because I've been doing it for enough years. I'm like, I guess this is true about me. I'm in Manhattan. I do a lot of indie game, but also have done some like big name games. And I like talking and thinking about games and speculative fiction and where they intersect and how we engage with them and things like that. And at the end, I'll tell you about stuff that you can read that I've written or play that I've made and things like that.
Yeah, I'm very excited to get your perspective on our topic for today. Craig, what is our topic?
We have one too many people on the show for our topic today. because we're going to talk about duet games, that is to say, games with just two people playing. That's a vague enough term that it can be like two players playing a kind of cooperative or kind of, you know, a game with two characters that are doing a thing and the game kind of guides you. It can be a game where it's one GM and one player, but the uniting force there being that it's just the two of you, and that presents a number of unique opportunities as well as challenges relative to a game where you might be playing with 5, 6, 7 people total, which, you know, there are things to keep in mind. And there are games that are suited and in some cases specifically designed for these types of play structures with just two people. So I thought, Sharang thought, finally chose this topic. Would you like to tell everybody why you chose this topic? You told us beforehand, and you don't have to use that answer. You can use a different answer if you want to.
Lol, a multiplicity of answers, right? I am an academic. It's complicated. So first off, out of the menu of topics this week, I'm like, given my tight schedule this week, it is final season coming up. This was one that required least reading for me to do. And I'm doing a lot of reading. I'm on my first thesis defense committee next week, so I have a lot of reading right now. I'm excited. It's a thesis about actual play. It's a master's thesis. I'm kind of excited. I'm actually learning a lot from reading the thesis because actual play is not my like area of study, right? So, but also I've worked on a lot of two-player games, and also I do a lot of my, many of you know, I mean, you both obviously know, but many of the listeners who might have heard me speak before know that one of the areas of design that I'm interested in and study, not just design, is games about intimacy. And many of those are designed to be two-player experiences. Not all, but many of them are designed to be two-player experiences. And so I'm like, okay, I actually have thoughts and some experience with this thing. I've also recently... So, not that recently, time flies, right? Oh, God, 2 years ago. So, not recently at all.
In the cosmic sense, ago, very recently.
Gods. 2 years ago, I realized about myself that for the most part, when I play longer solo journaling RPGs, it feels like work for me, right? Because I was talking to my friends about this, and like, yeah, I mean, you're a world builder and storyteller by profession. So if you're just doing it on your own as a game, it does not feel like a game. It feels like work. And I'm like, that might be it. I don't know, right? But I found that solo RPGs that are journaling heavy and that are long exhaust me. Until I tried playing Koriko, A Magical Year with a friend. And then once we're writing together, even if I'm the one physically doing the writing, so I'm in a campaign of Koriko right now with my friend Martin, and I am the one doing all the longhand, it doesn't feel like work anymore, right? It feels like I'm now playing a game and having a fun time. And so there's an interesting thing where for me, I have discovered that most solo journaling games are better as duet games for me, even though that's not the way they're designed to play. Like Koriko has a multiplayer mode, but we're not using that, right? The multiplayer mode is you are two different characters writing back and forth to each other. I'm like, no, the two of us, we're just going to write the story of one character, right? So that's another thing which I've found very interesting, where solo RPGs, for the most part, and only if they're long and journaling, there are many solo RPGs that don't need you to, that aren't very long, but don't need you to write and things. Those are different. But so solo RPGs have been on my mind a lot. I'm playing a number of these. Sorry, duet RPGs have been on my mind a lot. I've been playing a number of these solo as duet games. And of course, I've contributed and written a bunch of solo games. So I thought I have some, I don't want to say the word authority, that sounds horrible, some experience that I can lend to this topic.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the intimacy aspect of duet games is something it's an interesting factor. Obviously, that's one of the reasons why you might want to pick up a duet game, but also like, okay, I live with my partner. We want to play a game. I don't have two other people or three other people to play a game with. We're going to pick up and play. But every time I've done just a two-person LARP, it is really vulnerable and intimate in a way that a bigger group role-playing experience isn't always, because there's just the two of us to pick up what the other person's putting down. You know, you really have to make sure that there's no slack in anything that you're in, any of the dynamic. And that can be a really tough sell for people.
I have a vivid memory of, I was at the Dreamation convention one year. I've been at Dreamation convention for many years now. And I was running a game of Monty Cook Games, not just Monty Cook, there's a whole team there and they're all amazing. Monty Cook Games is The Strange, right? Which is a traditional in the sense of, you know, 4 to 5 people, three to six people, maybe, you know, GM, all that kind of stuff. And for some, whatever reason, that session, out of the 6 people who'd signed up, 4 of them did not show up to the game, right? Coincidences, all kinds of things. So 2 people showed up, and it's literally your point, Jess, in that it was very, I felt that was very hard, because normally in a game with lots of people like that, all of you are interweaving, you're telling the story together, and you pick up the storytelling slack, right? More people are putting cognitive load into the game. And so with just 2 players in a GM rather than like 5 to 6 players in a GM, to me, I mean, to be fair, I was also less experienced as a GM and game designer then, so maybe that's part of it. But it felt like, oh, this is harder. I have less to draw on. And so I think having fewer people, one of the challenges to overcome is that you have less input from lots of people, which could also be a feature, right? The bug is the feature. But it is something you have to think about, right? You have fewer people to draw on. And so maybe you have to design for that sort of thing, right? You have to design so that it's not a game that requires all this input from lots of different people. And also, of course, if you want a more number crunchy version of that, like in a multiplayer, by multi I mean more than 2 in this sentence, in a multiplayer game, if you have like a crunchy combat game, you can pick different characters or players can contribute different sorts of things, right? You can have the like old school idea of the tank and the DPS and the healer and the support, whatever, all that kind of stuff, right? You can't have that as much or it's harder to have in a two-player game unless the two players are playing. Like, theoretically, we could play a two-player game of D&D where one player is controlling the entire party of six characters, obviously. But that has its own challenges, right? That's
sure, you could have a player play a, you know, multi-class character that can do all sorts of different things, so you can that character can do all the stuff that's needed to overcome a lot of challenges, but that often has its own kind of foil, you know, trials and tribulations to deal with too. It you know, GMs have to keep in mind that there's no character that's ultimate power in one thing. Like, there's not a fighter who's like just obliterates enemies. There's not a wizard who can do massive, you know, spells. So you're dealing, the GM has to develop a, you know, challenges for that one player that are like, okay, I can take advantage of all the little different things you can do, all the little jack of all trades things that you are, but I maybe can't throw this big bad monster and at like, a single player, because it really requires like multiple people.
And yeah, and like the so I strongly believe, and I don't think any of the main designers at Wizards would disagree with me, that Dungeons and Dragons, one of the major aesthetic goals it has is to create a feeling of fellowship, right? Is to create this idea of you are a party, you're working together, like together you can save the day, right? And so making that a one player, one GM experience changes that vibe completely, right? It becomes a lot more about personal heroism and not about leaning on the support, right? Like, it is not a lot. I mean, we don't have the evidence for this necessarily. I haven't finished playing the world fully, but we don't have, I don't think we have the evidence that it is to disprove this, but it is extremely likely that D&D is inspired by Lord of the Rings, right? It is,
very evidently.
It is unlikely that that's not the case, right? And Lord of the Rings is all about that, right? It's all about like
there's
fellowship,
a whole book that,
and
the name of
it's
the
called
book.
The Fellowship, exactly.
The Fellowship
exactly.
Of the Ring.
Exactly, right? And so the vibe of that will be very different. So not to say that that's a bad thing to have that kind of game, but just that D&D and many games that depend on, are descended from, or use D&D as inspiration, which is many games. I mean, you could argue all games, but we're not going to that territory. Have this idea of like camaraderie and fellowship and working together, both from a narrative level and at a mechanical level. Right? Like there's a great essay in Journal of Analog Game Studies, I can't remember the title or the author exactly, I'm a bad academic at this moment, but it talks about this idea of interdependencies being one of the drivers of emotional affect in play. The fact that I depend on you in this game for something is automatically going to make me emotionally invested in you, right? And in a D&D game, because there are these differentiated, specialized class roles that do different things, it is designed to create these interdependencies and thus create this emotional affect and connection with each other, right? Which I think is very powerful and interesting.
Mm. The play negotiation too becomes even more interesting when you're playing a game where either both players are players in the game in the traditional sense, and when one player is a GM and the other player is the player in that traditional role.
Right, right.
I've played both styles of games, and they are very, very different. As someone who's played like the GM role in a two-player game, but I've never played the player in a two-player game like that. It feels a little bit, how can I explain this? When I'm the GM for just one other person, there's a lot of different pressure to perform, to act, to do all those things and kind of be on a little bit, even a little bit more than you normally would be.
Right.
Because
of this authority, right? This unequal authority. I mean, I'm going to be somewhat salacious in that when I am in a BDSM scene with one other person as a dominant, right? The sub, people are like, people who are not used to BDSM have this misconception that The sub is just there. The Dom is doing everything and is in control and blah blah. The Dom has a lot of pressure on them because it is on them to guide the scene so that the sub has a good time, right? And I, as a Dom, feel extremely pressured because I can be like, oh my God, I'm not like I was at this kink festival last week and I had scenes with some very experienced subs, and I had lots of moments of self-doubt being like, am I giving them a good time? They're so
Am I doing it
experienced, they've
right?
done, right?
Yes.
Right? And that is the same as being a DM in for one person, because this one person's laser focus is on you. And again, if I am running a game for a very experienced player, same thing. I'm like, oh, you've had some really great DMs in the past. Am I giving you a good story and things, right? And it's interesting, like during pandemic isolation, I ran a couple of one shots of Montica Games' Invisible Sun for one player only, right? Like one of my grad school friends who is not a self-described gamer, had never played a TTRPG. I was phone calling with her. I'm like, do you want to play Invisible Sun? She's like, what is that? I'm like, do you want to try it? And she's like, okay. And then this guy I was dating, same thing. He was an experienced gamer, but I'm like, do you want to play this together? He's like, okay. Because I was tired of Zoom at one point. I'm like, let's just be phone, let's just be audio only. And it was interesting because, again, that, just like we were talking about D&D, is a game traditionally designed, or designed, not traditionally designed traditionally for a larger group, right? And the pressures are different. I will say that authority and power dynamic thing aside, because Invisible Sun doesn't draw its main emotional things from combat solely, while I argue that D&D draws much of its effects from combat, it was a bit different because the crunchiness felt different, in that the pressure to like have a balanced combat and to make sure the enemies are behaving in the right way, whatever, was different. But there was still this pressure of like, am I creating a compelling enough story? Especially because Invisible Sun is supposed to be this like surreal, weird story. And I was like, am I being surreal and weird enough to hold your attention, right? And this authority thing is different. Now, of course, some games use that, right? So some of the listeners, obviously you both know, but some of the listeners might know that I was one of the co-editors of Honey and Hot Wax, right? Which is an anthology of erotic games that Pelgrane Press put out. And Jhenea Kemper in that game, in that anthology, has a game called Feeding Lucy, where one of you plays Dracula and the other one plays Lucy. And that game absolutely plays with this idea of authority, right? Where I have more power than you. I am Dracula and you are Lucy. But she does an interesting twist on that. So that distribution of unequal authority can be used in interesting ways, right? I can imagine a two-player, one GM, one-player game of Dog Eat Dog, which is a game about colonialism on islands, like with indigenous people, would feel very different if you have two players rather than multiplayers, right? So that authority idea can be used. But it does, in a more traditional game, create, in a less indie, more traditional game, create this burden or this expectation. And I think I'm rambling, so I will now stop.
No, I mean, I don't think it was rambling at all. I think like those are, especially when you're planning on doing a duet game, like those are considerations you had to make. Especially if you're deciding, like, you know what would be really fun? Running this for a stranger.
Yeah,
Let's
yeah, 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 yeah,
go.
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think it's easier with somebody that you're more familiar with. Like you mentioned a friend, you mentioned a partner. Like
Yes.
those are people that you already have established intimacy with, who you already know, like what they like and what their little foibles are. That's way
Yeah.
easier to reflect and play with.
That's actually a really good point. Even the simple aspect of, do we have like social chemistry together, right? Like I mean, we all know people who are like, they're perfectly lovely people, but we have no social chemistry, right? Hanging out with them is not fun, it's draining, right? And in a table of five players, that matters less because you're five players. But if I'm playing a one-on-one game with one of those people, I'd be like, oh God, this is so much work, right? And also, this question of authority. So Lucian Khan was the co-ed. So Lucian Khan is my co-editor for Honey and Hot Wax, but he was also the co-editor of an anthology called You and I, Role-Playing Games for Two, a number of years ago, which is on it's on Drive Through, I think. Also, a portion of profit from that goes to food banks, so people should support that. But I designed one of the games for that anthology, and I call it's a game called Hexed, where, again, this idea of authority is strongly used because one of you plays a freshman at wizard school at the end of your first semester, and one of you plays the school as the GM, and you have to give the other person a grade at the end of the session, right? So it's not competitive in that way, but it is like there is this I don't want to say adversarial because that's giving the idea that professors are adversarial to their students. They're not. But there's this like judgy component there where the GM is literally judging your performance. While we think of traditionally GMs don't judge your performance. Whatever you do, the GM like rolls with, right? But in that game, mm-hmm. You can get an F. And it's part of the game and part of that, right? If it's a stranger, maybe these scaffolds that games that play with authority are easier because there's a distinct, like, I am the authority figure, you are not. But if it's a more traditional, less weird game, it can be hard just because you're like, how do I engage with this person, right? And which is why people are often, like, I've been on numerous panels where people are repeatedly asking, again, the question of how do you do romance in games? Because this intimate experience with strangers can be challenging to do, right? And fraught as well, right? So
thinking of the different stresses, because like what we're hitting on a lot here is like the stresses that can come into play when you're playing different variations of a duet game. And one that strikes me as well is like the difference between GM and player versus two players that are kind of working, you know, in the game just works, has them kind of fill things. Is that the GM player dynamic is established from 50 plus years of role-playing games. There's a structure to it. The GM describes the situation, the players respond, the GM calls for checks, the players roll dice. You could watch it and from as an outsider and be like, okay, well, like the GM is talking, da, 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 da. And then you'd get to a point, you'd be like, okay, well, now this is clearly the spot where the player comes in. And then the player comes in and does it. Like an outsider could pick up that structure very quickly because of the roles that they're playing. But in a game where the two players are just portraying characters and they're going to have to fill in some gaps here and there, there can be, one player kind of gets into their character, starts describing what they're doing, and they get to a point and the other player isn't really sure where to go with that. And so now the first player has to kind of do more and continue to kind of, you know, give the other player a chance to process things and figure out, you know, there can be the structure. You think the structure is kind of there because there's just two players. It should go back and forth. And that's something that the players either need to be cognizant of, the game needs to make them cognizant that that's kind of part of how the game is played, or the game needs to be structured in such a way that it guides players to do what they need to do.
And there's a really interesting example that plays with exactly what you're saying, which is Vincent Baker's The Wizard's Grimoire series. There might be like four games in that, I think. I've mainly played two of them. But in The Wizard's Grimoire, there's one player and two GMs. No, one player and one GM. I think the second one is one player and two GMs. But in The Wizard's Grimoire, the interesting thing is that the GM does not need to know any of the rules of the game apart from this one paragraph. So you as the player play the wizard, and the way the game works is you keep asking the GM questions and narrating and then asking and then narrating that. So I'm like, I'm a wizard. Today I'm going to spend the day in my study trying to unlock the secrets of the grimoire. GM, who knocks on my door that disturbs my studying? And what does he do to annoy me? And the GM's like, oh, this happened. And then I'm like, okay, blah, blah, blah is happening. What difficulty do I find in blah, blah, blah? And then should I roll for this or do I manage to succeed? And then the GM says, I think you need to roll for this, right? And so it kind of subverts what you're saying, Craig, not subverts, it inverts, I think is a better word, this like roll and creates exactly what you're saying, this very specific structure that allows for this. It's a really, really interesting game that I assign to my students in some of my courses sometime because it's a bizarre structure.
And a really clever take on that. Maybe I'm guessing there's probably at least one game out there that, like this that exists because there are so many games. Right. Is a game that allows it to be played the way Sharon just described, but then can also be played more traditionally, where the GM is doing more of the guiding and everything. And if the structure can be played part, you know, method A and then inverted to method B, then now you've got a game that you can tailor to like who wants to play what role and what they want to have to deal with in the game itself. And so I'm always if you read any of my game designs, like the majority of them have some level of optional rules, or in some game systems, I call them intensity dials, where you can change kind of how some of the core functions happen and to just suit your group style. I love the idea of, you know, a duet game where you could play it GM player with both of those variations, and then you could also play as just no GM, two players, and then have to fill in gaps. Now, that would probably necessarily be a relatively rules light game, because otherwise you're easing the load just to add more load. Like,
which maybe, but
I think right, that there are all these like, all those options in one game would be like. I have a feeling I would read that and I'd be like, holy crap, this like might change my whole philosophy of game design. Like,
I know every single episode we share together, we're like, oh, here's an idea. We must make this game. So this is to add to that list, right? Let's make this. But there's something interesting, right? So there's something we've been talking about a lot of the challenges of the two-player game, but there are a lot of opportunities, right?
Yeah.
The mm-hmm. two-player game creates a very specific kind of intimacy. I'm using the word intimacy in this sentence, not in the like sexy sense, but in the like emotional sense, right? Like when you are playing with one other person, there is a kind of intimacy that's created. When I was in grad school, I took a class on haunted house design, where for our final, we literally built a haunted house for an evening. And one of the things we talked about there was,
oh, what's... like the Halloween haunted house. So like, how can you build a haunted house? You have to have ghosts in it.
We just murdered a bunch of people. We just like killed the chair of the department.
Holmes, all right.
So
you New Yorkers.
we have weird things.
You do everything you're on.
One of the big things we talked about early on was how many people should we allow in at a time into the haunted house? Because we're like a lot, like, our professors, like in immersive and interactive theater, the larger the group is, the more prone they are to start giggling and doing comedy. Well, if you're a very small group, the intimacy of the experience is preserved more easily, and you're more likely to be like, ooh, haunted house, and not, ha ha ha, look at this idiocy going on here.
And the person that makes the person that cracks the joke just makes everybody laugh nervously.
Right.
Instead of getting like a, you know, stand-up crowd reaction.
Right. And I mean, we all also know that it is a challenge to get RPGs to not devolve into silliness and slapstick, right? Ultimately, that happens a lot, right?
Yeah.
Which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but if I'm running Bluebeard's Bride and I want to create a very specific tone, right? For those of you who don't know, Bluebeard's Bride is literally an RPG about intimate partner violence. That is the theme of the RPG, right? It is one of the most brilliant RPGs created, I firmly contend. But you might want to create a different kind of emotional affect, right? And so a two-player game allows that control a bit more because of this intimacy, right? Which might be why so many two-player games, or not so many, so many games about romance and sexuality are two players, right? Because it allows for this interesting connection. And those that aren't feel different if they're two players or not. So right now, Plus One XP is working on publishing my new RPG called Leatherbound, which is a RPG that explicitly gets the players to have kinky sex with each other while they are playing the game, right? just continuing in my tradition of Honey Hot Wax and sexy games, right? I've only tested and I've tested that game like numerous times at like orgies and sex conventions and things. Only with groups. I've never run that game one-on-one. Because again, the vibe was very different, just like I was talking about earlier with BDSM. I mean, this is a BDSM game with one person versus a group, right? And so, for example, when Alex Roberts made Starcrossed, which for listeners, it is a romance RPG that uses a, I should say, tumbling blocks
No, it's
tower,
a Jenga
but
tower.
it's a
Everyone
Jenga
knows
tower.
it.
The official game says tumbling blocks tower because, you know, copyright. The original game is mainly two player, and then the expansion, which I've written for, has a three player version, right? But it's because this intimacy of this romance between two players is very, very easy to do, or come arises from this two player thing. Similarly, the board game Fog of Love, which I argue is almost a role playing game, and the game forces you to role play in a very clever way. Most board games that we know that have role playing elements, you kind of skip the role playing part, except Fog of Love, you cannot. Like, the mechanics don't work if you cannot role play. Or like the RPG put out by Darrington Press, The Last Gasp, are have this like romance component. And there's also this one I just bought recently, Elliot Davis's The Time We Have, a tragic zombie TTRPG, is about you and your brother, and your brother has just been like bitten by the zombie, and you play the game, you physically play the game through a closed door. Like, you have to like pass cards underneath the door and things like that. And again, this is not a romance game, but it predicates, is that the best word to use here? It uses this deep, intimate relationship as a basis, because the game like affords that, right? Like in one game, in these other games I mentioned, it's about this like deep romance, or maybe not so deep romance. I think most of them are quite deep romance. While this one is this deep tragedy of like brotherhood, right? And so the affordances of two player games, I think, are this really intimate, or the other direction, this really adversarial game, right? I mentioned Darrington Press, The Last Gasp. The Last Gasp is a romance game about nemesis. Like, you're two nemesis who have this romance. So it is using both adversarial and romance. But a lot of board games, a lot of two-player board games are about a deep adversarial relationship, right? I recently played, one of my friends had surgery and I like, couldn't move around a lot. And so I went over and I took the Watergate board game, where one of you plays Nixon and one of you plays the press. And it uses this like
I want to play that. That sounds
adversary.
great.
It's actually a really well-designed board game. It's really good.
Gonna pitch that to my history teachers at my school.
It's really cool. It's also very easy to learn and play.
And Nixon is one of those voices that anybody can do. So if you want to, if you're role
If you
playing,
really want to role play
you want
Nixon,
to do the cartoon version of Nixon's
everyone wants
voice.
to role
Oh my
play
God.
Nixon.
But it models adversarial relationship. Very, very well, right? So.
It's interesting because I think that there's another mode of duet play that you've already mentioned with the game that you mentioned about that Vincent Baker had written, and you also find this mode in a game like Cthulhu Confidential, which is a two-player gumshoe game, which is allowing one character, one person to explore a world. And to do kind of almost like an invest, I mean, Cthulhu Confidential is literally investigative, but I mean, you could say the same thing about a game where, okay, I'm a wizard exploring a grimoire. It's also very investigative, and allowing you to have like a spotlight scene almost with an audience, which is part of the fun about a role playing game in the first place, which makes it like with other players, which makes it different than solo play. Solo play, like, okay, there's no one there to evaluate my work. There's no one there to give me feedback. But when you are in a conversation in the game mode, I don't know. It does feel different. I wouldn't call a solo game it doesn't feel like work. Whenever I played a solo game, it doesn't feel like work. Like you had mentioned, it kind of feels like work sometimes. But when you're with another person, it feels more like play. When you're with another person, it also can feel like performance, which can be very, very fun. And that is one of the values that we can take out of role-playing games as well. It's that, and then you're not just playing like against some randomly generated prompts or your own imagination. You're playing in the world of also somebody else's imagination, their reactions, in this cool exploratory world where you don't have to share the spotlight. You do get to be a main character, and the fewer players there are, the more main character you get to be.
I love that idea, right? So Mary Flanagan in Critical Play, I'm sure I've cited her before on this podcast. I cite her all the time. She's my games professor from when I was an undergrad. Talks about games as social technologies, right? It's like design that allows different social things to occur. And this idea of I am being witnessed and I am having this multiple ideas that you brought up of I am being witnessed and also I am going on this exploratory journey with my friend is very powerful and potent in these games. I'm trying to think of like, what would it be like to play Brindlewood Bay as a two-player game, right? Mm-hmm. As a GM and a player. So for those of you who don't know, I've said that those exact words like a million times in this last hour. Apologies. But Brindlewood Bay is Jason Cordova's game of mystery solving as murder mystery solving grannies. But one of the innovations of the game, I mean, it's always hard to say innovation because some other game somewhere has done this as well, like you mentioned, Craig. But one of the things that this game popularized, which I think is quite innovative, is neither the GM nor the designer nor the players know the solution to the mystery at the start of the game, right? The players put together clues and then generate the solution. They decide, oh, these clues all point towards the fishmonger as the murderer, and then we're going to roll to see if I'm correct with factors, right? But that could be really interesting with one GM and one player, because this like idea of like, normally that would be like the GM knows the mystery and you don't, you're discovering. But if it's you alone coming up with the solution to the mystery in a clever way and the GM like helping you with that, I think that would be really, really interesting.
I think a lot of those kinds of games could really, really work well with that kind of like investigative and exploratory are basically synonyms in my mind, but that kind
yeah,
of
yeah, 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 yeah. And of course, if you as viewers are interested in listening to a lot of one-on-one games, I would be remiss if I don't, you know exactly what I'm going to mention.
Yes.
If we don't mention Jeff Stormer's Party of One podcast, right? Because Jeff Stormer does a really interesting job of taking both games that are designed one-on-one and game designed for bigger groups and running them one-on-one, and has like millions of episodes, not millions, that's exaggeration, but many, many episodes exploring different
figurative
games.
Millions.
So, right, figurative millions, right? That I think listeners, if you like the topic for today, you might want to explore some of those. I've been on it, I think, once with my game Hexed. But Jeff always had lots of different guests and things, so I think that would be a great resource to further the conversation for you after listening to us, if you're interested.
Oh yeah, I think that's like the treasure trove of duet play.
Yeah.
Just because of the absolute breadth of episodes, like you mentioned, there are many, many episodes.
Yeah. And that's interesting, right? Because this makes me think of the fact that, maybe, I don't know if this is entirely true generally, but I feel it is genuinely true that a board game that is designed for more than two players but has a two-player mode, in my experience, is usually weaker as a two-player game, while a RPG that is designed for for more people but we can turn into a two-player game is not necessarily weaker, but it will be very different and might require a bit more different kinds of prep, but won't necessarily be weaker. While I think it'll be a different aesthetic experience. While many board games, because the rules and systems are there, are just weaker. Because like I remember playing Lords of Waterdeep, which is a lovely board game, but there's so many cards which are like choose another player to do this to, or every other player does this. If you just have one other player, it kind of falls flat, those powers and cards. While in a RPG, you have other things going on, right? And you have rules adjudication in different ways and things, right? So, yeah.
It's I'm thinking of some other games that I've played that are designed that way, but also have two player modes. And they are all that exploratory sense. I mean, obviously the ones that are designed for the intimacy aspect of it usually just work. They'll work better as a duet game, and there aren't a lot of games that are about addressing intimacy and that sort of mode of play that exists for, a traditional sized role-playing group. Because, you have multiple people around, everyone's personalities are going to be meshing together. You're going to find some place in the middle, and that's a lot less predictable than just two people. But two people, you can kind of figure out where that's going to go. I wonder if we have any other tips for those designers who are listening who would want to design specifically a game for two players. Anything that's come up, or maybe they want to design a two-player mode for their game. What kind of tips or thoughts we could offer them as we start to close out the episode today?
Well, my a thought that comes up is if like think about okay, this has come up to me before. So I have played not a ton of, but I've played a decent amount of Vampire the Masquerade, right? And sometimes I have felt, would this game be better as a one GM, one player game? Because there are so many moments of my vampire is doing his own thing. It comes up again and again and again. A feeding scene, very few of the feeding scenes, Vampire the Masquerade are group scenes, right? We all have secrets from each other. We all have our own lair that we live in. We all have these like things we're trying to protect that we don't want others to know about, right? So not exactly the tip, the kind of tip you were saying, but a tip for designers is if you are finding that your game has a lot of like moments where you are spotlighting exactly one character and the other character are not present, maybe try and pivot and think about making that game as a one GM, one player game, right? Because many times I've thought like a Vampire Masquerade might, maybe I should run this actually. Vampire the Masquerade might work really well because it's even the original version, it was called a game of personal horror, right? And then you play with five other people, right? Maybe that game works really well as a game of personal horror because there are all these scenes of being alone and wrestling with your own demons as a vampire. With the kind, right? With like the humans around you, they don't count in this game. In that game, they don't count. Humans are pointless.
I feel like that dichotomy, that kind of clash of a game of personal horror that you play with five or six people, is it breathes better in a game like Vampire because what the storyteller system and those old World of Darkness kind of brought to the fore for role playing at the time, which was this very drama heavy, very kind of deep immersive, like really get into this. It's less about the rolling the dice and it's all about playing these political and personal relationships with each other, so that there's you can expect, or at least the designers and the early adopters of the games kind of expected there's going to be a lot of role play and everything. And so even if there's a lot of personal scenes, I'm going to be able to sit back and just watch the show. I'm going to be able to be enjoy as an audience member that this person, like Sharon, is having like this intimate scene of feeding their character, feeding off of some human, and or creating a new vampire or whatever it is that's kind of singular. And so I think you can kind of keep that in mind with design for games that you're gonna create kind of a 1v1 or player and GM mode for if you're gonna kind of adapt something from a game that you already like or a system that you already like, or if you're just gonna design something, is like keeping in mind the what you're asking the players to do in the game and how the other player who's involved is going to be able to enjoy that as well. Like if it's, you know, like in StarCrossed, it's very much about like the premise of the game is, you know, two characters who really, really want to and really, really shouldn't. So it's the tension that's always there. So anytime one player is talking and they're creating, they're building the idea of this tension of these two characters who can't be together, who really, really shouldn't, but really want to. And so the other person gets to enjoy that kind of like, oh, I don't know where this is going to go, the tension. And then there's the mechanics of like, will the tower fall? And, they succumb to their passions and that creates a different ending. And so you can build those types of like how those two people, especially because you're talking about intimacy and everything, is like how do the two players, regardless of how the roles function, how do the two players interact with each other and what does that intimacy provide? And what can your game give as an experience that another game with a larger group of people can't?
I think that brings up another idea. Yeah, I think your point brings up this other idea that could be a useful tip for designers is that we were talking about the idea of pressure and responsibility earlier and how it can be a lot in a two-player game, right? So maybe a well-designed two-player game allows players to mechanically do very few distinct things, right? And not have like 10 million systems to do an expansive sandboxy style play, right? Because in StarCrossed, your example, Craig, while you can do anything, mechanically, you're doing very few things, right? The mechanisms account for you saying something and touching someone, right? These are the two things that are mechanically interesting for you to do. Obviously, you can do all kinds of things. You can make dinner, you can do magic, you can fly, whatever that your setting allows. But what the game mechanizes is saying something to someone, to revealing something about yourself, and touching someone. These are the two things the game mechanizes. And that is good because the other player only keeps track of you. Now, of course, StarCraft doesn't have a GM, right? So the pressure is different, like we mentioned. But especially if you're making a game that has a GM and a player, having lots of systems that do lots of things, I think, creates a feeling of pressure for the GM to be like, am I doing a good job? I have to keep track of all those things. So maybe sticking to very few, like if you're making a combat game that's two players with a GM, maybe the only thing you do in that game is fighting. There is nothing else you do, right? That allows a focused experience. The GM is focusing on that mechanical thing. Maybe it's a game about killing your nemesis, and that's the whole RPG. And then you like trade quips with each other and try and murder each other, right? And you don't also go into inventory management and buying equipment and blah, 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 blah. You just do this one thing. That might help to make to reduce the pressure on a GM to do something, right? In the game Hexed, there is one kind of role only that you do, and the game is very specific, like what you're doing. You are like either doing studying scenes, okay, I guess there are two kinds of roles, but you're either doing studying scenes or adventure in the evening scenes at magic school, right? And so I tried to be like, these are constrained things that you are doing in like specific ways. So that's I think a second tip.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good general tip anyway for role-playing games. Like the mechanics you're putting in the game should serve to meet the purpose of the game that you're trying to create. And if you're going to be creating a game about exploring intimacy between two characters, your mechanics should be about exploring the intimacy between two characters, not about something else. That's just like a good way to do it. I think also a good place to look would be to look at other kinds of games that are not role-playing games that are for two players. There's a lot of great card games, for example, that are just two players playing cards. Those are places to look. Obviously, the Jenga style inspired games, there's a lot that you can work with there. There's a lot of people who do like StarCrossed hacks. You can hack a game that exists already and see what you like within that game. And then, of course, we barely even talked about it, but there is a wide variety of epistolary games out there, too, that are just letter writing between two people. It's definitely a different kind of game mode. It's much more closer aligned, I think, to like a solo game, like a solo journaling game, than a traditional role-playing game. But there's a lot of epistolary out there as well. And then I would like just for a little bit of other further reading and like recommendations, some things that I would definitely recommend checking out Cthulhu Confidential. It's an interesting way to do a gumshoe game. Has consequences, like you can have danger and your detective getting beat up, but obviously you can't die because you can't just make another character and go. There's no one else to pick up the
The
pieces if your
slack,
investigator dies in the middle of the adventure. But at the end you could die. And then speaking of like vampires and stuff, and obviously games about intimacy and queerness especially are great for duet games. Let Me Be Your Thrall by Milk Boy Games is an interesting way to explore also this tension, like we shouldn't, but I really want to, and I'm a vampire and you're a human. Uh-oh. So I would also recommend that. And of course, like you said, Party of One Pod, a great place to go if you're just in exploring this genre mode of play.
Nice.
Yeah, any other final thoughts, final recommendations?
I mean, I would encourage listeners to experiment and take a game that's not two players traditionally and be like, let's play it two players and see what happens, right? It might show you the limits of your game or your skills, not skills, your ways of playing as a GM and as a player. I think that'd be like, I kind of want to run some of these games. Like, I kind of want to run Brindlewood Bay as a one GM, one player game now, and see what comes of it, right? So.
Yeah. And the nice thing too about exploring with just two people is that you've only, if you completely bungle it, only ruin the evening for two
You've
people
only
instead of five.
bungled it for one person. And
Yeah.
if it's like Jess was saying, if it's like the partner you live with, they love you anyway.
Yeah, they're already there. Sorry, thank you so much for being on the podcast again. Always lovely speaking with you. Where can we find you and your stuff after this episode's over?
Yeah. So on social media, I'm mainly on Blue Sky as Sharung Biswas. So I'm also on I lurk on Instagram as Sharung Biswas. My itch.io, I don't update that much. It doesn't have most of my stuff. It'll have some of my stuff. Astrolingus.itch.io. But if you're really looking for a couple of my things, I have three big projects. My first book came out last year, which I think I spoke about on the podcast before, which is Honey, which is it's called The Iron Below Remembers. It was published by Neon Hemlock Press. It's a superhero, gay superhero novella. Check out Plus One XP. They're soon publishing, and they're gonna announce the pre-orders for my game, Leatherbound, which is a kinky role-playing game. And very soon, Scripted Games is gonna publish the game that Yansu Davis and I are making with the National Academy of Sciences, called Bloomfall, and the
Ooh.
website for that right now is labx.org/bloomfall. LabX is the lab at the National Academies that's working with us. And that's a game that has a group phase and a solo journaling phase. Like each week, you do both solo journaling game, and then you do a session together. So
That sounds really
check those
cool.
out. I think so. So yeah, check those out. Also, always, if you want to know some of these single solo games, I'm sorry, two player games. I've done some in the You and I anthology, which is You and I role playing games for two, and Honey and Hot Wax has a couple of two player games, including the one that I contributed, which is a two player game about frat boys who keep having sex with each other and then not talking about it. But yeah, that's me. Or and where do you find me? New York City. Awesome.
Yes. You can find me on Blue Sky. I'm Josco over there on Blue Sky. You can find my games over at wannabegames.io or wannabegames.com, or also with the Arkham Horror role-playing game. Now you can find some of my cool mysteries. They are really not for two players. You'd probably die. That's probably not gonna be a great experience. Maybe, I don't know. I haven't tried it. And yeah, if you are, we just got our events approved for Gen Con. So if you want to play a LARP with a lot of people, 30 of them, you can go check out my LARP out of the archive. It's an SCP and X-Files and Magnus Archives inspired LARP about some creepy artifacts. So you can go check that out at Gen Con. Yeah.
I'm Nerdburger Craig on Blue Sky. The website is nerdburgergames.com. You can get the games at DriveThruRPG. There's a duet game there called What Once Went Wrong, which is always hard for me to say, What Once Went Wrong, which is sort of a very light replication of the TV show Quantum Leap, which is a two character, largely two main character, time travel adventure kind of a TV series that got rebooted and then didn't last. I'm so sad. I really enjoyed the reboot. Huh. What?
I didn't know it got rebooted.
Yeah, they did like a couple of short seasons and then it got canceled. Take a look for it. It picks up the story. Like it jumps into, you know, 30 years later, here's people starting the Quantum Leap program back up again. It ties into characters and it's really well done. Unfortunately, it's not there anymore. And then keep an eye out for in May, the Kickstarter for Secrets of the Vibrant Sky, which is the last in the three solo games, which can be played each individually or all as one big long solo adventure. And there are rules information for playing it as a GM and player game, including as a younger player and older player type of game, because it is very just kind of a fun little fantastical exploration adventure. So it's really good for kids to play with older siblings or parents or guardians or whoever. There you go. And Nürburgring Games will be at Gen Con as well. It is our 10-year anniversary this year. Ooh, oh, and we got a corner booth, baby.
Good job. I
got upgraded to a corner. It's still a 10 by 10 booth, but it's corner. So it's going to have tables on two sides.
I don't often go to Indianapolis for Gen Con. I've only been like once or twice. But this boy I met at the King convention who I tied up was like, you should come to Indianapolis more since I live there. And I'm like, maybe I should go to Indianapolis more since you live there.
Maybe he should go to Manhattan more because Indianapolis is kind of...
I tied him up, right? And the Men Roping Men Conference is in New York City this year. So I did suggest that to him. We'll see.
If it gets you to Gen Con, I'm all for it.
Yeah, the only time
I always love to meet in person the people that we are talking to here. I've known you for years now, and we've never met in person.
And we've never met. So I was at Gen Con once when I was designing for Cryptozoic, and they took me. And then I've only actually been one because the second time I was going as part of the writer's circle, and I got COVID the day before I was gonna fly. Luckily, I'd bought flex tickets because I was worried about that kind of thing. And I couldn't go, and I had to cancel all my events. And it was sad because the day before, so it wasn't even in an advance of they could remove the events and put different people and stuff. They just have to cancel it because I got COVID.
Yeah.
So I should go again, but yeah.
It's a fun time. It's just very crowded. It's definitely not a duet place. You cannot have an intimate conversation.
And it's not a place to go if you have COVID.
No. thank you for our opening and closing theme song, Steph Sachs, for Awel, which is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you, Steph Sachs, and thank all of you for listening. And we'll see you back here next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.